Blog Talk Radio.
Last week was out of town on vacation. Spent some time up in Door County, annual trip I make up there. So appreciate you being with us tonight. Thanks for tuning in. Wanted to take a little bit of time first to say a little thank you to all the listeners out there. We've actually last week, and I don't know if it had anything to do with the fact that we didn't broadcast last week, but the episode, the show from the 23rd of June was actually our highest listened to show since we began broadcasting. So thanks to all the listeners who listen both live and from the podcast. There's a large amount of listeners that tune in from the podcast. So we'll certainly want to express our appreciation for tuning in to the program. I'm going to bring Dan on here for a second, our call screener. Bring him in. My name is Nick Clark, host of Well Armed Radio, chairman president of Wisconsin Carry. And we've been doing the broadcast now for probably going on 2 months. We've been doing the Well Armed Radio broadcast, Wisconsin's only specific exclusive right to carry gun rights related radio program. Dan, how are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you, Nick?
Good. We just a couple minutes before the show, actually about 45 seconds before the show, we were testing the microphone again and had some issues. So I had to quick reconnect the line. So I'm gonna now do my audio check here live with Dan. So how does it sound, Dan? Does everything sound good on your end?
You sound clear, but you sound like you're in a bathroom. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't tell you I'm broadcasting to the bathroom today. So. All right. Well, Dan is our call screener, so call in, talk to Dan. He'll put you through. We regular practice now. What we're going to do is, since so many people listen to the broadcast through the podcast, I have the open invitation that anybody who listens to the previous week's broadcast can call in. And we'll take the first 15 minutes or so of the show. People can call in and talk about any topics from the previous week that they'd like to express their opinion on. So we'll certainly make that available to you today. Dan will take your calls, put you through. When Dan takes your call, he'll get a little quick snippet of who you are, your name, where you're from, and then what topic you want to talk about, and he'll put you through. So I'll throw Dan back in the green room, the screen calls, and so it's me, Dan, and we've got our producer, Hugh, on the other side of the glass here, who we don't give Hugh a microphone. We keep him bottled up. So, Dan, I'll throw you back in the screen room, and we'll talk to you later in the show.
All right, sounds good.
That's Dan, our call screener. Feel free to call in. Most important thing for me is I'm, obviously want to get input from the listeners. And we're 2 weeks, excuse me, 2 months into the show, and I want to make sure that we're talking about the topics that are interesting to you folks out there listening. And in that, you know, your input is certainly important to me as we move forward with the show, and your participation, I think, makes the show better. So certainly be welcome to call in. The number to call in is 646-716-8739. Again, the number to call in is 646-716-8739. So be welcome to call in, talk to Dan, he'll put you through. Wanted to we were off last week. As I said, I was up in Door County. Good weekend. Weather turned out okay, a little bit iffy on the forecast. They talked about a possibility of rain last weekend. Went up on Friday, kind of dived the raindrops in the drive up, hauling my boat. Got to Sturgeon Bay, just past Sturgeon Bay. We started to see a little bit of rain, but just a tiny bit, just barely enough to get the roads wet. Got up to Sister Bay, where we were staying, and weather a little bit, you know, cool. Almost felt like a fall day, but it was dry. Saturday turned out to be a pretty good day, but there was a north wind, which is worst kind of wind for boating on Green Bay. And I've got a large boat, but it's still pretty rough out there. We dropped in at Sister Bay and went down by Peninsula State Park. Went inside. There's a nice little island, Horseshoe Island, that makes a nice cove. So once you got into that cove, it was really nice. I mean, it just felt like a tropical paradise. Not super warm, but it was okay. And then riding back, about 6 o'clock, we left the cove. And again, the cove is just glass. You kind of look to the east and to the west, outside of the Horseshoe Island there, and see big waves rolling around the island. But right there in that little cove, the tall trees on the island, it was real nice and protected. It's a nice little party spot. I sat there. There's probably about 10 boats in there, some other yachts. And about 6 o'clock, we turned around to head back up to Sister Bay, which is only about a 10-mile ride by water, maybe not even. But they said 2 to 4 foot waves that day, and I'm telling you, it was 4 to 6 feet and all of that. And I've been out in worse waves, but not for that much of a haul. You know, sometimes here in Milwaukee, we head outside to break water on some rough days just to get out there, but tour around for 5 minutes to come back in. But our 7-year-old was scared to death. She started crying. The waves were pretty big. You kind of got to turn into them and head northwest right into the waves, and then kind of turn to the side and run towards the land, kind of run the troughs and the crests and get some speed to get back. But it was a good time. So Sunday turned out to be a better day. Sunday the weather was nicer, and there was tons of boats out on Green Bay on the Eagle Harbor by Ephraim. So it was a good time. So again, I want to thank all the listeners who tuned in on the 23rd. That was our most listened to show ever. This is now, I'm going to call this our Independence Day broadcast. This is the 4th of July was Thursday. Thursday was the 4th. And, years past, a lot of times when you hear people be sticklers for words, because, Thursday was the 4th of July, and when they refer to the holiday itself, they call it the 4th of July. And I used to, in the past, not think much of it. you'd hear people say, no, it's not the 4th of July, it's Independence Day. And I thought to myself that was just, really being a stickler. But I think, to be honest with you, now, just in light of where this country is going, and when I say going, I'm going to say going in terms of the federal government, because I really don't think in terms of the state governments and local governments, I think we're doing better. We're going in a better direction. When you look at states passing right to carry laws, states moving towards constitutional carry, I think when you look at the federal level, it's easy to think and say that things are getting worse, and I think at the federal level they are, but at the state level, I think there's a lot of reason for hope. And that's why, for me, Independence Day, I think it means more to me now than it used to, because I think it's time for people to recommit themselves to freedom and understand that words do matter, and it is Independence Day. I think the Declaration of Independence is one of the greatest documents ever written, and has some of the most insightful philosophy in such a very short document. And I like to, often when I do presentations to Tea Party groups and other speaking events, I like to, some of my topics at times I use the Declaration of Independence as a springboard into my discussion. And I'm going to do that today, just again, this being our broadcast closest to 4th of July Independence Day. and want to use this as a springboard for today's show, not to let the holiday and the spirit behind the holiday go unspoken about in this show this year. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. And I think, you know, when you deconstruct that, when we look at the Declaration of Independence, and there's other documents, you know, if you go further back in history, you know, the Magna Carta, there's other writings and documents that express similar sentiments of people's innate rights as human beings, you know, laws of nature and such. But that's the way that the Declaration of Independence put those together in the context of government and how our country was formed, I think is something that I'll always hold very, very sacred in terms of a philosophy. And I think that it's something that, you know, obviously we should share with our children, make sure that they're understanding not just what they might be told in public school, but, you know, what that really means. So on this, you know, this past Independence Day, you know, truly one of my favorite holidays. You know, some people disagree with me that, you know, for some people Christmas is their favorite holiday, not in the gift-giving sense, but for religious, the foundations for their religion. But for me, Independence Day, I mean, freedom is my religion, and the Constitution is my Bible, and Independence Day is one of the greatest. The Declaration of Independence, one of the greatest documents, and Independence Day, one of the best holidays. So we'll leave that there. Again, open line today, call in with any topics. And I'll throw this out there as a teaser or as a suggestion. I'm interested to hear how people got into the carry movement. I'd like to get to know the audience better. And throughout the week, sometimes I get emails from people, sometimes expressing things that they like about the show and sometimes things they don't like about the show. I've had people tell me to stop talking about voting, so I'm not going to do it. But I've had that suggestion. I'd like to hear, you know, how you got into the carry movement. You know, for myself, I was 21 when I bought my first handgun, and I don't really. My parents, you know, I was brought up in a hunting family, but certainly, you know, self-defense and Second Amendment wasn't ever a topic. So I'm not quite sure where and how I started to strike an interest. Because no one in my family had ever talked about, you know, carrying for self-defense or even home defense. I mean, guns were something that you used for hunting in my family growing up. But I was 21, and my first gun, a Glock 23, was my birthday present to myself when I turned 21. And it's something that I think even at that time, you know, I recognized the power of the gun as a tool of self-defense. And it appealed to me for that reason. But I also, you know, it just seemed to me something that was very, you know, very powerful, again, a tool. My involvement in the right to carry movement really started when I was, I graduated from college and moved up here to Milwaukee, and I watched an infomercial, and there was an advertisement, again, this infomercial was a discussion of what happened in California when, you know, I always thought, you know, National Rifle Association, my grandpa was a member, but you know, my parents weren't. And I just saw my grandpa wearing his NRA hat, never asked him about it or anything. but that infomercial talked about what happened in California, where initially they just registered, you know, let's pass some legislation and suggested that everybody had to register certain types of weapons. And then I want to say if it was a year or two after that. It looks like we've got a call coming in here, so we'll take this call in a few moments here. But you know, what happened in California? They passed legislation that required people to register guns. You know, you have to turn them over, you had to register them. Then a few years later, they banned that type of gun with new legislation, and they had a list of people who they could go confiscate those guns from. to me, that was the moment. So that was my epiphany. That's when I thought, you know what, this is real. This isn't, you know, the NRA isn't just a bunch of fear mongers that, you know, fearmonger for their own personal gain. This really happens. So that was it. That was when I got involved in the Red Scare movement. I can't remember if I moved up here in 98, and I can't remember if it had to be around between 1998 and 2000, because I can remember specifically where I was when I saw that infomercial. I remember the apartment that I was living in at the time, townhome house at the time, and I lived there from, it was either 99 or 2000, but that was when I lived at that apartment. So, you know, that's something that stuck with me, and I'm interested to hear how you got into the carry movement. You know, that's my story. That's my first gun when I was 21, but I still wouldn't have called myself a right to carry enthusiast. But then when I was, 23, just moved up here, 23, 24, before I was 25, I saw the infomercial. So we've got Bob from Alcorn. He's going to talk about his venture into the carry world. Bob, thanks for being on Wild Arms Radio. How are you?
Good, Nick. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to give you my opinion, what worked for me. I was a city driver in the city of Chicago, even though I live up here in Wisconsin. I was phased out of Milwaukee. And with all the random violence that occurs throughout that city, and I traversed the entire city, the worst and the best parts, in Gary and Ammon, Indiana, I chose to go armed.
Bob, turn your computer down, Bob. You're getting a little bit of echo here through.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, just turn the volume on your computer down.
There we go. Okay, we took care of it. Well, anyways, with all the random acts of violence occurring throughout the Chicagoland area, I made a decision to carry a snub-nosed revolver. I kept one in each pocket, and fortunately, I've never had to pull one to use in self-defense, so I've been blessed.
Yeah, and how long ago was that you started when you had that decision to start to carry?
That was about 15 years ago. I've been retired now 1 year, and I even carry when I go on Bradley's in Delavan. You've been shopping in Bradley's, I take it.
Oh, yeah, Bradley's. Actually, I know the folks over at Bradley's. Linda, who works at Bradley's, is her and her husband, Mike. I call my adoptive parents. So if you've been to Bradley's, you probably know Linda, blonde-haired lady who's worked there for a long time. So now you're bringing up my old back in the woods. I grew up in Delavan, so.
Oh, sure, sure. That's a real nice community.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I appreciate it. That's it's interesting to hear. You know, a couple weeks ago we had someone call in who their intro into the carry movement was actually the Madison 5 open carry incident from a few years ago. So I'm always in that person that had never carried before in their life and hadn't really been interested. So it's great to hear people's story, and appreciate you calling in.
Indeed, sir. You have a nice evening. This is a great program you have going. Good, very, very, very good thoughts, and good luck to you.
Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate the thoughts. Good night.
Bye-bye.
So that's Bob from Elkhorn, and I hope that we get more calls on this. I mean, I know I see the statistics. I know how many people listen live, and I know a lot of them will call in, obviously, because we don't get a lot of calls during the show, but I hope that I'd be interested to hear other people's story of how they got into the carry movement. You know, I find it fascinating, and hopefully there's a range. You know, like I mentioned a few weeks ago, we have a gentleman who wasn't in the carry movement at all up until hearing about the Madison 5 open carry Culver's incident on the radio, and got interested at that point, and that was his launching moment into right to carry. So I'm interested, to hear your story. 646-716-8739 is the phone number. There was a particular moment in your life, and I think for some people, you know, it's probably, you know, their parents or their father was a gun rights advocate, and for other people, they probably had to come into it on their own. And certainly, be welcome to call in and share your story. 646-716-8739 is the phone number here. And again, feel free to call. We'll take some more calls on that over the course of the next 15 to 20 minutes while I go through some of the other things that we have for this week. We talked about right to carry and what brought you into the movement. And I can't help it. I was watching some movies this past, I'm going to say it was Friday night. It had to be Friday night. I was watching a movie called The Call. And I'm not big into, you know, Hollywood and movies and actresses. I just put a theater in my house, so I'm going to start to watch more movies. But I know Halle Berry is one of the actresses in this movie. But The Call is basically about a 911 call center in Los Angeles. And Halle Berry plays, I think the actress or the character in the movie is called Jordan. So she's operating a 911 or as a 911 call dispatcher in this large call center in Los Angeles. And she takes a call from a girl who is in a house during a break-in. And, you know, so many movies, the plot is centered around, you know, some kind of it could be, I guess often it would be described as a crime, so some kind of conflict. You know, every movie, often there's a conflict. You know, you could go back to high school or probably, you know, middle school, and you talk about movies and stories. There's, you know, there's the antagonist, the protagonist, and a conflict. And that's what makes for good storytelling, whether it's a movie or a book. And sometimes the antagonist and the protagonist is the same person, so that, you know, there's a good guy and a bad guy. And sometimes it's a one person, meaning someone's having a personal struggle. But in this particular movie, Halle Berry plays this actress, or plays a character named Jordan, who's a 911 call center operator. And she's taking a call from someone who's in a home, and there's an armed, or there's a break-in in progress. And she's on the phone with, the victim is on the phone with Halle Berry's character, Jordan, and comes in, she's told to hide in a room. And this whole time, obviously, you know where I'm going with this. You know, as a right to carry supporter and someone who practices the right to carry for self-defense, I mean, just you're watching this, and all you can think is, God, if they were just armed. And I can't tell you now, with you know, the more involved I get, and obviously, sure, people get in the carry movement, and you see things happen on movies and TV shows, and that thought has to run through your mind. It's, God, if they were just armed, just able to protect themselves. And, of course, you know, that would probably make a very good storyline. So Hollywood needs unarmed victims, so to speak, in order to have a story. If the victim in this movie, The Call, had been armed, there would have been no story to be told. You know, she'd have shot the intruder when he came into her room. But basically, this girl gets kidnapped, murdered. Halle Berry, the 911 call operator, is on the phone the whole time. And so that's the first thing as I'm watching this thing, and say, God, if this girl just had a firearm to protect herself against this intruder. And then later in the movie, you know, this first victim is attacked and kidnapped and taken out of the home, and they find her later. And of course, this haunts Halle Berry's character, Jordan, because she couldn't stop what happened. And 6 months later, as the movie moves along, they do that jump forward 6 months, and she's in the 911 call center again as an instructor this time, teaching other operators. And there's another call that comes in. There's a girl being kidnapped, and she's in the trunk of a car. And again, now that this girl being kidnapped was probably not 21, so I wouldn't expect that she would have been able to carry or be armed. So she gets thrown in the trunk of a car, you know, chloroform is abducted in the parking garage, chloroform over her face, thrown in the trunk of a car. And now this guy's driving down the highway with her, and she comes to while she's in the trunk of his car. And she has a cell phone in her pocket, calls 911, and she gets back on the phone with Halle Berry's character, Jordan. And so this character, the 911 operator, Jordan Halle Berry, talks her through the situation and tries to help her. But then, the next time in the movie, there's a situation. She punches out the tail light of this car and sticks her arm out. And they're driving down the freeway. Someone sees it, calls 911. That call comes in. They start to locate the car. And then the car senses that something's up when he sees, the car next to him looking at him and realizing something's up, jumps off the freeway. So they lose the car again. And there she's, Halle Berry, still on the phone with the victim in the trunk. And then the guy pulls over and opens the trunk and, starts beating on the girl that he's abducting and saying, look what you've done, And then there's someone who sees it. There's a chauffeur driving a black town car who sees it. And he comes up and says to the guy, "Hey, is everything okay? You know, see your taillight was busted out. You know, there's paint pouring out of," because Halle Berry, the 911 operator, had suggested she pour paint out of the hole in the taillight so that would be a sign for law enforcement to be able to find her, track her, seeing paint still on the road. But so this chauffeur who sees the kidnapper, doing something in his trunk, comes up and says, "Hey, is everything okay?" And the kidnapper says, "No, nothing's wrong, you know, go away." So the guy goes back to his car and picks up his phone, starts to call 911. The kidnapper realizes this guy's suspicious, goes over there with a shovel, breaks the glass of his car. And I'm probably ruining the whole movie. If you haven't seen the movie, The Calling, I'm spoiling the whole outcome of the movie for you here. But breaks the side window of the car and basically starts, beating this guy with a shovel. And again, second time in this movie where I'm thinking, God, this is California, a movie set in California where they're a may-issue state, so the guy may not have even been able to get his hands on a concealed carry permit. But again, second time in the movie, I'm thinking, God, if this guy was just caring for self-defense, he'd be able to do something here, protect himself and just, protect stop this kidnapping, which at the time he didn't know it was a kidnapping, but he knew, obviously, once he was under attack, he'd have the right to defend himself. So movie moves on. The chauffeur who's trying to be the good Samaritan, call 911, who then gets beaten by the kidnapper, he gets thrown in the trunk too. So now there's the kidnapped girl in the trunk, there's the chauffeur in the trunk, they're both in the trunk of this guy's car. Again, back driving down the road. Stop again when they open the emergency hatch, those little levers, release levers to get out of the trunk. And he ends up beating the chauffeur. The kidnapper ends up beating the chauffeur to death and puts him back in, or stabbing him to death with a screwdriver, puts him back in the trunk with his kidnapped victim, the girl, and then goes to a gas station. He's running out of gas. And again, 911's on the phone this whole time. They're trying to locate this vehicle, this kidnapped victim. So they pull into a gas station. The kidnapper gets out of the car to fill up the car with gas. And at this point, the victim who's in the trunk, the kidnapped victim, the girl who's still alive, realizes that the back seat has that little center console part that you can push open. She pushes that open and pokes her head out and starts screaming for help. And there's a gas station attendant who sees it. So the gas station attendant comes by and sees that this girl's screaming, "I've been abducted." And so he sees the kidnapper filling up with gas. So the gas station attendant whips out a box cutter. And now box cutters served the 9/11 terrorists very well in carrying out their terrorist act. But I mean, I'm telling you, a box cutter is a poor thing to bring to a self-defense situation. So this gas station attendant is wielding a box cutter, trying to go threaten the kidnapper that he needs to step away from the car. Well, as the box cutter wielding gas station attendant who's trying to be the good Samaritan approaches the kidnapper, the kidnapper pulls the gas nozzle out of the gas tank, squirts gas all over the gas station attendant, and then throws a lighter on him and he walks away in a ball of fire. But that was like three times through that movie where I'm just sitting there, I'm watching it with my fiance, and I'm thinking, God, if this person had just been carrying for self-defense, again, would have ruined the movie plot line because there would have been no victim and no crime. But just, in that, my passion for people being able to defend themselves, and you're watching this movie and you're kind of feeling like you're in the movie. So I wonder, again, we're still open line here, so I'm curious if anybody else has that same kind of reaction now when they watch movies, being more involved in the carry movement, seeing people that aren't, a couple of years ago that thought didn't cross my mind. 5 years ago watching a movie, that would have never crossed my mind. We couldn't carry here in Wisconsin, and when you see someone on a TV show be a victim of a crime, you didn't, other than fighting with, hand-to-hand self-defense type fighting, it didn't really occur to me. But now every time I'm watching a movie, that's all I can think of. And then the second time it happened this weekend, I'm watching Tombstone. Great classic movie. Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer, love that movie. So I throw that in my theater. I'm watching that, and there's a part in that movie where Wyatt Earp and his brothers are going to, or his brothers start it. They're going to, become the law and be sheriffs of Tombstone, because there's so much violence and everything. And the first thing they do in response to all the violence that's taking place in town is they walk up and they start posting, no gun signs. They start banning guns. And there's a part of the movie where, I don't know the actor's name, but Kurt Russell in the movie is Wyatt Earp, but it's his brother, basically says to everybody, we're not telling you you can't own guns, and we're not telling you you can't carry guns. We're just telling you you can't carry guns in town. So, and this isn't the first time I've watched the movie and seen that. And I obviously, the character Wyatt Earp in the movie is a great character, and I, enjoy his attitude and his approach to the role. But that piece of the movie really bugs me, where, again, the knee-jerk reaction to violence throughout history, and obviously that's the movie, but around the time that took place, Wisconsin's concealed carry ban was in place for like 130 years or something like that, since like the 1870s. So it just made me think, even though this is a dramatization in a movie, that's that same knee-jerk nonsense reaction of, hey, let's prevent violence by just banning guns, goes way back to colonial times. And you think that over the course of 130, 150 years, I don't know what year Tombstone was set in, that movie was set, but don't people study history? All these supposedly educated, East Coast intellectual elites, don't they study history? Haven't they looked and seen that, whether it's in Tombstone, again, fictional movie, but the premise is solid. You ban carry from the good guys carrying guns, and in this movie Tombstone, that the cowboys are the outlaw group. This group of hoodlums called the cowboys, they still come into town with their guns. So it's really, 150 years later from when this movie was set or whatever, and it seems like some politicians still haven't learned anything. So that was my two comments on that for this week, those two movies, Tombstone and the movie The Call. Two different angles there, but just something interesting that I found. Well, moving on, the next thing I have, this came up over the last 2 weeks, and this is in New York, after the Sandy Hook shooting, New York decided to pass legislation that, you probably heard this, that limited, the number of rounds, I think it's to 7 rounds, whole host of other restrictions. Again, this is completely emotional, reactionary type legislation in the wake of the Sandy Hook shootings. So in New York, there's all these counties that have decided to push back against it's called the SAFE Act. So all these counties in New York, and New York is kind of like Chicago in that the legislation is dictated by, your big populist counties. And now I'm going to fail my geography lesson for the day because I don't know the name of the county that New York City is in. I don't know the name of the county New York is in, but I think that there's 50 some counties in New York, and over 50 of those I think there's only two or three counties that haven't taken this action, but 50 plus counties have passed resolutions rejecting the SAFE Act, this new legislation that New York State passed. So again, a situation, and we've got another call coming in here, I see, from Southeast Wisconsin, so we'll get to that caller in a moment. But this next clip I'm going to play is testimony from Aaron Weiss, who is a Iraq War combat veteran, and he's speaking against the SAFE Act. And this is a Dutchess County hearing. And again, in New York, 50-some counties have already, almost all the counties have already rejected, passed resolutions rejecting this state legislation, the SAFE Act, that was passed in the wake of Sandy Hook. So he's speaking in this clip to the legislators at the county level who are against the resolution. And when they're against the resolution, it means that they support the SAFE Act that was already passed, which totally infringes, mandatory background checks, limits guns to 7 rounds. So I'm going to play this testimony. A couple weeks ago, I played some testimony from a woman who was at a hearing, and I forget her name now. It's been too long. But, I said that sometimes you hear people say something, you think everything has been said, you think every point has been made, but sometimes you hear something that is stated better than you've heard it before. And so I'm going to play this testimony from Aaron Weiss, and hopefully I've got the audio right here. It might be a little bit loud, but if it's too loud, I'm going to adjust the mic. Don't grab your speakers. I'll adjust it here, and we'll again blame the producer Hugh here for the audio. But this is Aaron Weiss, Iraqi combat war veteran. It's about almost a three-minute clip, so I'm going to let this play.
Hello. My name is Aaron Weiss, and I live in the town of Poughkeepsie. I'm a combat veteran of Iraq, and I'm also a law enforcement officer. I attended the Public Safety Committee's last meeting in regards to this resolution, but I didn't say anything because I wanted to hear what everyone else had to say. And I heard some shocking things from some people and some legislators. They said that it took a lot of courage to pass this SAFE Act. Apparently, my definition of courage differs from yours. You see, if it was really so courageous a bill and it took so much courage to pass it, then why was it done in the middle of the night when no one could see it or read it? That's not courage. That's a mafia-style sit-down to divvy up what's good for the bosses. Courage is taking the right and true course of action, not the politically expedient one. And anyone who is proud of this law must also be proud of the Patriot Act, the TSA, imprisoning Japanese citizens in World War II, since all these actions were spurred on by emotional fear and rammed through in the name of public safety. Another issue is the insistence of certain people to stand on the graves of dead children and challenge those that disagree to say it to the parents' faces. Well, I, for one, will pick up that gauntlet. First off, why is dead children your battle cry? You didn't say anything about the hundreds of Chicago children being killed, and for some reason you only scream when it happens to wealthy white ones. And yes, I will say to anyone's face, my right is more important than your dead because I fought for it firsthand. I washed the blood of my friends out of my Humvee, and I picked up their mangled bodies, and I fought day in and day out. I did more things that you people can't imagine. So yeah, my right trumps your dead. I earned it in blood. I gave up a lot for this country, including my youth, and better men than me gave up a whole lot more, so that all you, myself included, could enjoy the rights that are guaranteed to us in our Constitution and Bill of Rights. And we didn't go through all that to come back home and watch the surrender of what we fought for happen based on the demented actions of a couple madmen. So in closing, I would like to address specifically the legislators we all know who are going to vote against this resolution. I understand you will vote against this resolution based on some misguided sense of the public good. However, as a law enforcement officer, I'm curious to know about your true resolve. Since voting to take away someone's rights is totally different than being asked to enforce it, I want you to consider this. If you support the SAFE Act so wholeheartedly, are you willing to stand with law enforcement members and lead from the front to enforcement? And what I mean by that is if a constituent of yours feels so alienated by this law and the manner in which it was passed that they refuse to comply with it, are you willing to stack up on their front door and go in first? I bet if a clause was in this bill that required you, the elected leadership, our elected leaders, to go in the door first, I bet you would not be so steadfast.
So there it is. And that one lead-in I forgot to include in that was that this Aaron Weiss, who just gave that testimony, he's a cop. So, and first, it's refreshing. I mean, obviously, this guy went to Iraq and sacrificed his time here on Earth for his country, watched friends and fellow soldiers die. And what a better person to carry that message to those legislators. And then the fact that he's a police officer, and I've always felt like here at Wisconsin Carry, we would love to see more people in law enforcement that truly embrace their role in protecting rights. Instead, it seems like too often our rights are at odds with law enforcement because they choose to view it that way. But here's someone who really gets it, and his testimony was just fantastic. And so I heard that this week, and I wanted to play it for you. I don't think there's a lot more to say other than, there's people who can say things and it's so powerful. And I got to believe that there's still legislators, and I'm certain there were some at that county hearing who didn't give a shit and who still think that they sit there behind their desk with their little legislative pen and think they're going to save the world and feel good about it. And then you got someone like Aaron Weiss who went to Iraq and did something about it. And he's got to come back here and watch the freedoms that he fought for get penned away by legislators, and it's disgusting. And there's another, I'd like to say another word, and this is the internet, so I could probably get away with it, but I'm not going to say that word, but it's something disgusting what these legislators do. And these people go over there and they give up their lives for our freedom, and then we have legislators pissing that freedom away, and that's offensive. Good news, the resolution to reject the SAFE Act passed Dutchess County by a 20-4 vote, so that's the good news. The bad news is four people sat there and heard that testimony and didn't care. They heard that testimony, and they were really willing to, with their pen, but again, this is just a resolution, but with their pen, refuse to reject the encroachment, the loss of our rights. And another thing, I don't know if you caught it, but at the end of his testimony there, he talks about what they call a stack up. And what that is in law enforcement, you know, if you go and SWAT style into a building, you know, you stack up in front of the door. You got the guy with the battering ram first, and then behind him, you got the guy with the riot shield. Behind him, you got the guys with the M4s. And that's a stack up. And so his challenge to the legislators there was, anybody who wants to pass this legislation, if you have to do what he has to do, now as a law enforcement officer, he could potentially be asked to go take the guns from a person who might refuse to comply with this unconstitutional act that New York's legislature passed. And here these people with their legislative pen sitting behind a desk are going to go ask the guys like Aaron, who fought for our freedoms and who support our freedoms, to go be the one to execute the usurpation of our freedoms by the enforcement of these unconstitutional laws. So that's Aaron Weiss, Dutchess County, New York. Great work, Aaron. Fantastic testimony. So we're going to move on. The next topic I have for today, and this came up, you know, we were off for 2 weeks. We had no show last weekend. So I had a story that I was going to share that came up 2 weeks ago, just after our last broadcast, that Mississippi's open carry law, Mississippi passed an open carry law. I suppose here in Wisconsin, you know, open carry was the only way that we could carry for a couple of years before we finally passed our concealed carry law. And a lot of people really thought that the concealed carry legislation would be the promised land, and if we could just get concealed carry here, and then we could do away with this silly open carry business. And then in other states where they've already had concealed carry, you know, I've told people from time to time that they're still interested in open carry. You know, you got places like Alabama, Florida, Mississippi. I mean, you know, these are hot states where sometimes, you know, the clothing that one might wear, you know, here in Wisconsin where we need a parka 9 months out of the year, it's pretty easy to conceal carry for most people. But, of course, I say that in jest. We don't need a parka 9 months out of the year here in Wisconsin. It's only 7 months out of the year. But in Florida, where they have warmer weather, and a lot of times people are wearing shorts and a T-shirt, and it's difficult to. And in Florida, I believe in Florida, it is that it's a violation. It's a misdemeanor to print. So if someone can, you know, when you're concealed carrying, it has to be concealed. And if you're printing through your shirt, you know, that's, you can get a citation for that. So these states are pushing for open carry. So here in Wisconsin, we already have constitutional open carry where you don't need a permit to open carry, no permit taxes, no government mandates. But other states that don't have that are actually pushing for what we have. So fortunate for us here in Wisconsin that we do have open carry, constitutional open carry, and it is codified that it is not disorderly conduct. So, but here, July 1st, a new law giving Mississippi residents the right to openly carry firearms without the need of a gun permit will go into effect. And again, this was back at the end of June that I picked out this article. So then, you know, we didn't have a broadcast last week on the 29th, or is it the 30th? And so then, before I had a chance to bring that story to you, we have another story. A Mississippi judge blocked Mississippi's open carry law from taking effect July 1st. And just this past week, we have, this was published on Tuesday, the Associated Press, the Mississippi Supreme Court says it won't undo a circuit judge's order that's blocking an open carry law from taking effect. So Mississippi was supposed to have open carry July 1st, didn't happen. A judge issued an injunction to block that. And then the Supreme Court decided not to overrule that block. They'll still hear the case at some point, but they're not going to overrule that block of the law in the meantime. So So Mississippi's open carry law remains in limbo. While we're on that topic of lawsuits, I'll segue into this. Wisconsin Carry, as you know, filed a lawsuit against the Wisconsin Department of Justice a few weeks ago, challenging the permanent rules that they put into place for Act 35, Wisconsin's concealed carry law. Under the temporary rules, the emergency rules that have been in place for almost 2 years, 180,000 people were issued their permits. There was no problems. But then the permanent rules, the Department of Justice, and I'm going to editorialize here, but the Department of Justice, in a exercise of their incessant desire to control the population, control people through legislation that legislatures didn't write, but that they're adding these rules that surround the administration of the law, put some additional restrictions. They're limiting class size to 50-1 for instructor-to-student ratio. Wisconsin Carry filed a lawsuit to challenge some of the things that the department has written into the rules. These rules are things that were not part of the written legislation, but then the department gets to make rules because they're in charge of implementing the concealed carry law. Now, with that said, Wisconsin's concealed carry law specifically said that the Department of Justice shouldn't go crazy with rulemaking. They said that that the department shouldn't make any rules that make what the legislators wrote more strict. And we believe they did. So that's the reason we filed this lawsuit. So again, we were off last week. My update last week would have been that in a surprise move, one that our attorneys didn't see coming, the Wisconsin Department of Justice chose to exercise their right to have the case removed from Waukesha Circuit Court, which is where we filed it, and have it removed to federal court. That was an interesting move. So basically what that means is instead of an elected judge who was elected by the people of Waukesha County, which is where we filed the lawsuit, which is where Wisconsin Carry is incorporated out of, you know, we're a statewide group, but we're incorporated here in Waukesha County. So that's where we filed the lawsuit. Instead of having state court and elected judges by the people of Wisconsin litigate this issue of a state law, the Department of Justice chose to have the case removed to federal court to let a federally appointed judge come decide what Wisconsin law should be. And we think that's a disappointing move from J.D. Van Hollen's department. And I don't know who gets involved in this decision-making process, but J.D. Van Hollen is the attorney general, and that's his department. And whether it's the overreach of these rules themselves or the decision to remove that case to federal court, count me as one of the people that's been very disappointed in J.B. Van Hollen. You know, back when open carry passed, a lot of people hailed when open carry, when he issued that memo saying that open carry was legal and it wasn't disorderly conduct. And again, that was issued. People really hailed him as a hero for gun rights. And a lot of other people were like, yeah, you know, he wasn't making as bold of a statement on behalf of right to carry as we might hope for. First, he just issued an advisory memo that open carry was legal. He didn't issue a mandate, which he could have. I mean, in his role as attorney general, he could have done something more strong than an advisory memo. And second, he only issued that advisory memo after he was really forced and prodded to by a number of cases, some very public cases of open carry, people being arrested for open carry. So now we're seeing, I think, more and more demonstration. And then after Act 35 passed and the Department of Justice started going crazy the first time around, they were trying to mandate a four-hour class. They were trying to require a whole bunch of other things. And at the time, Senator Galloway, who was the author of legislation, was still in the Senate. She got involved and said, no, you know, this is not what we intended. But it's surprising that a department headed up by a supposedly conservative attorney general, we had to go to those lengths. I mean, he should have been, in my opinion, should have been on top of that and said to his people and on his staff, hey, you know, you're overstepping. You know, there are things that maybe we could push the envelope and do as far as rules, but we shouldn't even try to do that. But, you know, no help from J.B. Van Hollen there. I know the NRA had to get involved and Senator Galloway had to get back involved in order to keep the department from putting these restrictions in the emergency rules. And now, again, now they're trying to do it again with the permanent rules. So, again, just a disappointment. J.B. Van Hollen from my standpoint, is a disappointment. So the DOJ opted to have this case removed to federal court. The part of the case that allowed that to happen was we make multiple arguments in the lawsuit. One of the arguments is that by the text itself of Act 35, it says the Department of Justice shouldn't make rules that are stricter than what the legislators wrote in there. And we believe they did. So using the law, Wisconsin law, as the basis of our argument, that's one angle that we took with the lawsuit. Another angle that we took was equal protection. And we use the Equal Protection Clause, which is a federal statute. We use that to make the argument that, make another argument. So we're kind of attacking from multiple angles here. And by relying on that federal law, the Equal Protection Clause, that's what gave the Department of Justice, that's what introduced the opportunity for them to have this case removed to federal court, and they chose to exercise that. And forget the, you know, again, disappointing that J.B. Van Hollen would choose to go that route when he's supposed to be pro-gun, but that's what gave them the out to take this to federal court. So the hearing that was supposed to be scheduled for tomorrow, July 8th, is off. So if anybody was planning to attend that hearing in Waukesha County, that's not going to happen. That hearing was for the injunction that we were asking a judge to immediately suspend the permanent rules and go back to the emergency rules so that we could continue to operate our concealed carry classes as we have been with more than 50 students per instructor. So that by removing it to federal court, that hearing is off. There was a conference call with our attorneys and Judge Clevert, who's the judge at the federal level that our case was assigned to, and Clevert is a Clinton appointee, so you can read into that what you'd wish. But he asked us to write a brief for the reasonings why the Equal Protection Clause was appropriate for this case. Rather than do that, we decided to not use the Equal Protection Clause angle and instead refile our lawsuit in Waukesha Court again and use just the statutory language from Act 35 as our basis of our argument. So we'll be back in Waukesha County Court, back two judges. So a little chess game going on here, but I wanted to bring you up to speed on that with regard to Wisconsin Carry's lawsuit. And we'll have more on that in the future as that litigation moves forward. Next thing I have on the docket today was an incident here in Milwaukee with Associated Bank. And this happened here in Milwaukee with Associated Bank. I'm confident that, you know, thousands of our listeners and thousands of people across the state of Wisconsin who, you know, carry concealed, support the Second Amendment, may likely patronize Associated Bank. And I wanted to talk about a situation that happened. One of the Wisconsin Carry members went into Associated Bank branch on 27th and Morgan here in Milwaukee within the last month or so. And he was open carrying at the time. Now, Wisconsin Carry banks at Associated Bank. I know I personally bank at Associated Bank. After Act 35 passed, there was an article in a couple of different business publications. Well, one was the Milwaukee Journal, and then also there was an article in the Milwaukee Business Journal. And it talked about all these banks, and basically the vast majority of banks were choosing not to post. The vast majority of banks were choosing to allow concealed carry, or allow carry in general, open carry, concealed carry. Obviously, it would be a really bad idea for a bank to prohibit their customers who might be coming carrying large amounts of money to make deposits or leaving with large amounts of money. It'd be a really bad decision by a bank to prevent your customers from having the right to defend themselves. So one of our members was asked to leave the Associated Bank on 27th and Morgan. This gentleman was open carrying at the time. And he was told that Associated Bank had a no weapons policy. Now, they don't have signs, but supposedly, and according to this manager, they told the open carrier that they don't have signs, but if they saw someone carrying, they were supposed to ask them to leave. Now, I'm a Wisconsin Carry does their business banking at Associated Bank, and I'm actually an Associated Bank customer as well. I have many accounts there. So I'm a premier banking customer, which basically what that means, the premier banking customer is the same as a regular customer, but they want you to feel special. So they give you, they want you to feel special because you have large deposit accounts there. So they give you a special phone number to call and a special ATM card that says premier banking. But other than that, It's the same as a regular banking customer. But the good thing is when you call the 800 number, you get a live voice instead of phone prompts right away. So I call my Premier Banking customer service number, and I ask them what their policy is. The reason I'm going through this story is because it's a perfect demonstration of how willing people will be to misrepresent a company policy or misrepresent fact and swear by it, and they really don't know. They're really talking out of their you-know-what. So initial customer service agent that I spoke to said that he didn't know. He didn't know what their policy was. Said he was going to check with a supervisor. Comes back to me after being on hold for a minute or so. Says, I checked with my supervisor, and we do not allow carry. I said to him, okay, I said, I don't want to question what your supervisor told you. But before I go out to Wisconsin Carry's thousands and thousands of members across the state and inform them that while all these other banks, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, Chase, while all these other banks allow carry, Associated does not. So I'm like, we can't put the toothpaste back in the tube here. So before I go out to membership with this, can you please double check? So she's going to check with someone at corporate security. A few hours later, I get a call from Robert Molina, who's corporate security for Associated Bank. And Mr. Molina assured me that Associated Bank did not allow carry. He said that they don't have signs, but that they ban carry if someone sees that, you're carrying, they will ask you to leave. Now, I said to Mr. Molina, I read this article in the Business Journal, and they actually quote in this business journal. So while I'm on the phone with them, I said, Robert, and then Robert's adamant that that's the company policy. So I said, Robert, hang with me for a second. I Googled this story from about a year and a half ago, and there was a gentleman, and I don't have his name in my notes here, but there was an executive with Associated Bank who was actually quoted in this original article from the Business Journal about their policy, and this executive from Associated Bank said that they wish that their customers would leave their guns in their car, but they're not going to ban carry, they're not going to put up signs. And said that they're in the business of serving customers, not in the business of enforcing no guns policies. So when I read that to Mr. Molina, he said, well, let me go back and double check this. Now, again, 2 minutes before this, he was swearing to me, very adamant, that this was their policy. He was 100% positive, didn't even express the slightest hint of uncertainty. So I get a call back an hour later from Mr. Molina, and he obviously went and checked with the person who had been quoted in that article, who was obviously higher up on the food chain than he was. And came back and said, Nick, I appreciate you bringing this to my attention because I was unaware. He said, we do allow carry. We wish that customers would leave their guns in their car, but we don't ban carry. And, I wasn't aware of that policy either. So I bring this up because it's just a very insightful anecdote, insightful story about how willing people will be. You could go into a pick and save, and you could go into a retail store, and you'll be surprised how willing people will be to state a policy that they actually don't know for certain. And they'll state it and swear by this fact. But I'm going to tell you, one suggestion here. The quickest and easiest way to test someone's confidence in what they just told you is to ask for it in writing. So if you're at a store and they tell you that the corporate policy is that they don't allow carry, and there's no signs, just real politely, especially if it's a corporate type store, a chain, real politely ask if they could put that down in writing. And real quickly, you'll find out when you ask someone to put their name on a paper and document something, you're going to find out really quick whether they're bullshitting or not, because they're not willing to, anybody could say, oh, he misunderstood me. If you go complain and go run up the food chain, but to stick their name on a paper and state a company policy and for a low-level employee to put their name on it, you'll find out real quick. And so that's my suggestion. If you're at a place, a business establishment, and they're not posted, and someone comes up to you and sees that you're carrying openly or notices you're concealed carrying, maybe they see you printing and they say that, they don't allow carry in here, that's my suggestion, is to real politely ask if they could put that in writing and get their name. That way you'll find out. I suspect that, 9 times out of 10, that person isn't willing to do that because they probably aren't really aware of what the policy is. So that's that story. Right around 9 o'clock here, again, my name is Nick Clark, chairman of Wisconsin Carry, host of Well Armed Radio. I don't know if sometimes we have people join us throughout the broadcast. So have been suggested to me before that I introduce myself from time to time. You know, we don't take commercial breaks through this program. With that said, we actually do Wisconsin, or excuse me, Well Armed Radio does have its so I don't have the contract on yet, but there's a business called AJ Firearms Cleaning, which is our first official sponsor. We should have some commercials from them running next week. So thanks to AJ Firearms Cleaning for being a sponsor of Wisconsin Well Armed Radio. And you know, certainly if anybody's listening and you're interested in having you know, being in our infancy here of this show, virgin territory, we've only been doing the broadcast for about 2 months. You know, I make sponsorship opportunities available to people for very, very, very reasonable rates. You know, as I grow the audience and grow my demographics, you know, I obviously want to, I think at some point in the future, the rates that I would charge for sponsorship are going to be more in line with terrestrial radio stations, AM radio. But in the meantime, certainly, you know, if you have a business that you'd like to advertise and sponsor Well Armed Radio, you know, feel free to give me a message. And then with that said, you know, even if you have any other feedback on the show, the contact email for Well Armed Radio is Well Armed Radio, all one word, wellarmedradio@wi.rr.com. So if you have something to share, comment, feedback, criticism, feel free to send me an email at wellarmedradio@wi.rr.com or join our Facebook page, just facebook.com/wellarmedradio, and we'd be happy to hear from you. So that's the Associated Bank topic. The next, a couple quick ones I want to run through here, then I want to get to, we're going to spend our last you know, half hour, 20 minutes of the show on the George Zimmerman trial, which is, you know, kind of heated up here now, and I think it probably has about another week to go. Just to make you guys aware of some stuff going on, Gabby Giffords, who is the former congresswoman who was shot in the parking lot of a grocery store, convenience store in Arizona, I think it was a couple years ago, she's out doing the Rights and Responsibilities Tour. So I found out this information from, I'm a member of, with my position with Wisconsin Carry, I'm a part of a group called Gun Leaders, and it's an email list with the heads of right to carry, non-affiliated, so non-NRA-backed groups, so these grassroots groups across the country, and one of them is Grassroots North Carolina, GRNC, which is a very active, very impressive organization. Grassroots North Carolina, I think a lot of you guys would really be impressed by with what they do and the velocity with which they do it. But this Gabby Giffords has a Rights and Responsibilities Tour, they're coming to North Carolina. So this has been, I think this is the tail end. So reading from the article here, gun rights groups staged a protest Sunday at the Pitt Restaurant, where former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and her husband, astronaut Mark Kelly, met to support tighter gun control laws. Giffords and Kelly's Rights and Responsibilities Tour is a week-long swing through seven states, and that just wrapped up, yesterday. The goal is to call for the immediate passage of what they call common sense gun safety laws. It's been about 2.5 years since Giffords was injured in a shooting that killed 6 people and wounded 12 others. And of course, I'm interjecting here, let's not forget that there was actually an armed citizen at that convenience store when that shooting happened who went out, concealed carry, I won't say concealed carry permit holder because Arizona has constitutional carry, but was checking out of the grocery store where the Gabrielle Giffords was speaking on a podium in the parking lot when the shooting occurred. And he was out there prepared to, he didn't have to fire his weapon, but he was prepared to. Fortunately, the shooter's gun had jammed and some you know, people closer to him had already grabbed him as the armed citizen was approaching. But that armed citizen was there to end that carnage. So the people over at GRNC and these guys are great. These a very impressive group. They pulled the, you know, they staked out the airport where this private jet that's flying Gabrielle Giffords and her husband around the country jumps them off in North Carolina after they had just come from Portland, Maine, where apparently they had another event. So seven states, and what they're doing here is obviously some of these well-funded groups, anti-gun groups, have a sole or two sole funding sponsors. So you might have someone like Mayor Bloomberg who's going to throw $14 million of his own money. You know, when Wisconsin Carry wants to go out for money for a lawsuit or whatever, you know, we have to go to thousands of members and get a couple bucks from each one. That's the reality of our situation. You know, you've got some wealthy individuals like Mayor Bloomberg who just one person, and I support the free market and I support the free speech, so I'm not arguing against his ability to do so. But I just think it is telling and indicative that, you know, that how the media doesn't spend the time talking about how this is one person, you know, Mayor Bloomberg throwing $14 million to impose, in part, his personal desires on legislation that we all live under. Now, this particular case, Gabrielle Giffords, her rights and responsibilities tour, this is a funded by an organization called ARS, which is Americans for Responsible Solutions. I think Gabrielle Giffords and her husband are trying to become the new Jim and Sarah. Is it Jim Brady? Sarah Brady. You know, the new Brady group. Brady was President Reagan's, I forget what his position was, but, you know, Jim Brady, I think it's Jim Brady was shot when President Reagan was shot. He was hit in the head and suffered handicap from that, and now Sarah Brady and the Brady Bunch and the Brady Foundation are, you know, one of the have been a strong anti right to carry, anti gun rights group for the past 20 years. But it appears that maybe Gabrielle Giffords is trying to be the newer, younger, her and her husband are trying to be the newer, younger face of this anti rights movement. And so interesting information here. This Challenger 600 is the plane they were on. GRNC, Grassroots North Carolina, pulled the tail number off of that plane. Now, every tail number on a plane, you can find out who owns the plane and where that plane has been. This is all public records. So they found out the plane is owned by Montford Aviation. And Montford Aviation is owned by the Montford Brothers, which is the same brothers who own the Colorado Rockies. And third generation family owners of a successful beef business that they sold to ConAgra for $300 million. Several years back. So that's where, you know, you can go to Wikipedia and Google the Montford, or Wikipedia the Montford Brothers and read all about them. But it sounds like that's one of the people that are funding this Americans for Responsible Solutions tour, sponsors of the Rights and Responsibilities Gun Control Tour, probably footing the bill for the jet, you know, limos, SUVs, and hotels. Again, that's not confirmed. I'm just speculating here. But Americans for Responsible Solutions has raised apparently $11 million and plans to raise twice that for the 2014 election cycle. So, you know, that's the guess about who's paying for the plane. The plane returned to its home near Denver, Colorado this afternoon. So today, Sunday. So if someone, you know, Grassroots North Carolina is up on this. But this nonprofit, Americans for Responsible Solutions, organized this trip, which is just this past week passed through Las Vegas, Cincinnati, Anchorage, Alaska, Manchester, New Hampshire, Portland, Maine, Bismarck, North Dakota, and now North Carolina. So it's interesting, those seven states that they passed through. Clearly, the people from ARS think that there's some vulnerable legislators in those areas. And that's the reason why they chose those seven states. So I haven't yet done the research to see which legislators they are, but there must be some squishy pro-gun legislators. Could be Republicans, could be Democrats in you know, Nevada, the Las Vegas area, in Ohio, in Alaska, New Hampshire, Maine, North Dakota, North Carolina. They're really trying to target. So that's that. Last topic of the day, and hopefully we'll get some call-in on this one. George Zimmerman trial. This trial has been going on for a couple weeks now. We've had updates from the goings-on here on Low End Radio. We're going to end the show with this today. I'd like to get some feedback from callers. First, two things. One is, what's your personal feeling? And I ask that because when this story originally broke, I guess now it's been over a year ago, when the story originally broke, there was a lot of criticism of George Zimmerman, even by folks who were pro-gun. Now, a lot of that initial criticism by pro-gun folks was because they were relying on news reports from outfits like NBC, who edited the 911 call that was made to make it sound like it was a more nefarious encounter than what the full 911 call later revealed. But I found it interesting. You know, I listen to a lot of conservative talk radio here in Milwaukee and around the state, and one local host, Jay Weber, has changed his tune on this one. And I think this is interesting because when this case first broke, Jay Weber does WISN in Milwaukee, and Jay Weber was totally bashing George Zimmerman, called him a wannabe cowboy vigilante, wannabe police officer, Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry. You know, he was really critical of George Zimmerman, and he's really softened his stance. So I think, it's interesting to see some of these local radio talk show hosts who aren't really that. And that's one of the reasons why I started Well on Radio. It's my frustration watching some conservative, supposedly Milwaukee talk show hosts try to cover gun topics and really not do them justice, and sometimes take a squishy, apologetic backseat approach to the right to carry. And that truly is one of the reasons why I want to do Well on Radio, because whether it was watching Charlie Sykes throw constitutional carry, Charlie Sykes and Jeff Wagner, Mark Belling, watch them throw constitutional carry under the bus. And Charlie Sykes was the worst of them. I mean, how he threw constitutional carry under the bus back when we were working on that legislation was just shameful. Vicki McKenna is the only major radio host here in Wisconsin who supported constitutional carry, so kudos to her. But conservative, the reason that we don't have constitutional carry here in Wisconsin is because of what conservative talk radio did. We didn't lose constitutional carry because of anti-gun folks. We lost it because of pro-gun folks who threw constitutional carry under the bus in spite of us getting it to the floor of the Senate. But I digress. Back to the George Zimmerman trial. So it's interesting to see Jay Weber last week when he was talking about the George Zimmerman case. He's really changed his tune. I mean, he's really, maybe we'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say he just took the time to really do the research. Maybe, the other side of it might be he's seen that how strongly the pro-gun community has stood or suspended judgment, I guess what we should say, how strongly the pro-gun community has decided not to rush to judgment like all the anti-gun folks did on this issue. but Jay Weber really has changed his tune on this George Zimmerman. That was something interesting from this past week. But so just to recap, going back to George Zimmerman, and here's what I want to get from the audience today is your opinion on two things. And one is, do you think it was justified? From what you know so far, do you think George Zimmerman should be convicted of second-degree murder, or do you think he was justified in what he did? And that's my first question. So, do you think he's? And my second question is, what do you think the jury is going to decide? So, those are two totally different things: what we might think and what the jury is going to think. And maybe my third is what it is your prediction. So, I want your predictions on what the jury is going to decide, and like your opinion of his guilt or innocence, your prediction of what the jury is going to decide, and then your prediction of the outcome. You know, are we going to have riots? What's going to happen when they when that verdict comes down, depending on what that verdict is? So feel free to call in. I'm interested to get your input, 646-716-8739. And again, if you're listening from the podcast, tune in to next week's show live, and we'll take the first 15 minutes and we'll take some more calls. And we'll be going over that. There'll be more of the George Zimmerman trial that we'll discuss next week as well, obviously, as that case continues to move forward. I don't think the prosecution has rested yet, so the defense still has to go. But once the defense, all indications so far, I mean, the people that have gone on, the witnesses for the prosecution, many of the political pundits and media pundits have said how many of the witnesses for the prosecution have not been good witnesses and not done any favors and turned out to almost do more benefit for the defendant than the prosecution. And I think that's really the basis. My opinion on that is that when you have a weak case, that's what you're going to get. I think that this should have never been charged. I think that the evidence is lacking. I think that this is politically motivated charges. And so just to recap here, we have the original incident. And the one thing I want to say is everybody knows what happened with this George Zimmerman thing, but that original criticism, people have said that, he shouldn't have gotten out of the car. And that's why he was being a vigilante, because the 911 dispatcher told him, we don't need you to do that. We don't need you to follow him out follow him with your car or get out of your car. But that's not, testimony even in the trial. The police officer said that there was nothing illegal about following Trayvon Martin through the subdivision. Nothing illegal about that. In your neighborhood watch, you have every right to be a good witness. You have every right to follow someone suspicious through your property. You don't have a right to assault them or anything like that, but you have every right. So just because the police said, we don't need you to do that, are you following him? George Zimmerman said yes, and they said, we don't need you to do that. That's no indication of guilt. And I think that's what a lot of people initially said. Well, he disobeyed the police's orders. Well, that's not an order. The police just said, we don't need you to do that. You have every right to follow someone and be a good witness. So, the other witnesses that have come through for this case, John Tell, I don't know her last name, but John Tell was the person who was on the phone with Trayvon, and she just really got ripped apart on the stand. And by ripped apart, I mean just caught in lies, and her demeanor and just her whole attitude, I think it would be a turnoff to the jury. And of course, I don't know. The jury is made up of all women. It's an all-female jury. And I would think that they would find her attitude and her testimony very suspicious and very troubling in terms of, taking her word for it and sending someone like George Zimmerman to jail on the testimony of a witness as poorly spoken and as shady by changing her story and being rude and otherwise just arrogant on the stand as she was. But the other people that have testified and their, of course, Trayvon, this past week, Trayvon Martin's mom testified that she said that, she was sure that's her son's voice heard screaming, despite the fact that, crime experts, voice analysis experts have said that you can't determine, that they're unable to determine whose voice is heard screaming on a 911 call for help. Then Trayvon Martin's brother was called to the stand, and he testified that was Trayvon Martin's calling for help in the 911 call. Yet, in an earlier interview with the news media, months ago, he said that he couldn't tell who that was screaming in the 911. But of course, now he comes to the stand, now he says it was his brother. So just all the prosecution's witnesses, I think have been, more helpful to the defense than the prosecution. And again, I think that's a facet of this being a real poor case. The prosecutor in this case didn't get to make that decision. There was a special prosecutor appointed to decide if the charges would be filed. And now the prosecutor who's in charge of litigating the case, of trying the case, is has to basically, make chicken soup out of chicken, what. So he's not, the prosecution here hasn't been given a lot to work with. There's been legal experts across the country who have talked about how poor the evidence is here. And if there's a conviction here, which I don't believe there will be, so that's my prediction. I think that George Zimmerman will be found not guilty. I think he is not guilty. I shouldn't say that. I think there's no way to know. I think that based upon all the evidence that we've seen so far, there's no way to know for sure who was the aggressor. But our system of justice is based upon beyond reasonable doubt. And I believe that there will be a reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury that, and I don't know what the specific jury instructions will be, but I think there's a reasonable doubt in the minds, there should be a reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury that George Zimmerman acted properly in self-defense. There should be a reasonable doubt that they won't be able to get beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not justified in acting in self-defense. I think there is reasonable doubt that should exist, and for that reason, he should be found not guilty based upon the evidence that we have. Now, we truly don't know. I think the injuries to George Zimmerman, eyewitness reports that Trayvon Martin was on top of him, George Zimmerman's own statements. I think it's shameful. They're letting George Zimmerman's past history be part of the discussion in court, that he took police technical college school classes for police science or whatever the course title may be, trying to set up the foundation of him as a wannabe cop, but yet they're not allowing any testimony that introduces what a thug Trayvon Martin was. And we know he was a thug. I mean, from his Facebook postings, all the things that pictures of him smoking drugs his disciplinary history from school. I mean, this kid was trouble. He was a thug, suspended from school. None of that has been able to be introduced. But yeah, George Zimmerman's previous history of going to technical college classes for police science, that's been admissible. But so I'm interested in your take. Hopefully we'll get some calls on this. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show. 646-716-8739. I'm not sure if the show will wrap up this week, but I'm interested to get your predictions. Predictions for me would be, what do you think? What's your opinion? Was he justified or not? Second was, what do you think the outcome of the case will be, guilty or innocent? And third, what do you think is going to be, what's going to happen? Are we going to have riots? Are we going to have civil unrest? Are we going to have another riot scenario if you remember, for some of our younger listeners, I might be dating myself, but after Rodney King, the officers who were charged with beating Rodney King were acquitted. That's when those riots occurred back in L.A. Was that the 90s or was that the late 80s? Reginald Denny, the truck driver who was pulled out and beaten randomly during those riots, the L.A. riots. Could we see something like that? 646-716-8739 is the phone number here if anybody's got an opinion to share. Otherwise, we'll be wrapping up the show here in a few minutes. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Some people, I think it's fair to say that this case was George Zimmerman's attorneys to lose. A lot of the national law experts have, Alan Gershwin? Is a well-known, renowned attorney who said that based upon the evidence here, he doesn't think this case should have ever been charged, and that he thinks that it would be expected that the jury would find, or that a prosecution would not be able to make a case against George Zimmerman. That said, we saw what happened with O.J. He walked. So, but it'll be interesting to see. My prediction is, I'm not sure. I think in some ways, time is especially with our drive-by media culture, a little bit of time passes and the outrage dies very quickly. I don't expect riots. I do expect your typical race hustlers like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton will be on national media talking about what an outrage this is. Those guys have to do that. I mean, that's their career is fanning the flames of racial tension. So they need to do that to further their careers. But I'm interested to see what happens. I don't expect there's going to be riots. I think that the outrage is going to be limited to the news media. I think the outrage that we'll see from the general public is not going to be existent. I don't think we're going to see riots and protests in the streets. I think a lot of people have had the chance to either tune out or inform themselves and take a look at the facts of the case and put the outrage and the hysteria aside and really take a more honest look at the evidence. And in that, it's not the hunting down of an innocent young black juvenile youth in this private gated community. It's not the outrage that they once thought it was. So I'm gonna go over here and I'm gonna grab Dan because since we don't have a color on this, I'm gonna put Dan in the spot. And Dan, how are you? I can hear him reaching for his phone. Dan, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
So Dan, what's your take? Trayvon Martin. So I got three questions for you. So question number one is I think I'm going to know where you're going with this one. So I'll say, has from when the when this first happened, what was your take? Second to that, once the after the initial media blitz or whatever, now what's your take on whether he was justified or not? And then what do you think the jury's going to find, and what do you think is going to be the result after that?
Well, going back to the beginning when it all first happened, for me, I tend to find myself being much more skeptical about what's reported in the media. That's just, I guess, been ingrained in me through years and years of listening to things like talk radio and just being a little bit more critical, a little bit more skeptical about what's being reported. So I wasn't real quick to pass any knee-jerk reaction judgment on that entire situation. I kind of wanted to wait for more information to come out. And going back to that time, if you remember, it seemed like right in the very beginning, the media backlash was that Zimmerman was obviously in the wrong here, and Trayvon Martin was just an innocent victim in this whole thing. And very shortly after that, more and more information started coming out. It was like within a few days, all of a sudden we had the police photographs and all that stuff, and it started making you think, oh, yeah, look, there is more to this story than what you were originally telling us. So that being said, I don't know that my opinion has changed a whole lot. Even now that the trial has started, I think the trial is just starting to affirm some of those thought processes that existed in my mind back when it first came out. As far as what happens here, I tend to think that there is going to be a preponderance of doubt here. As you said earlier, I don't know that they're going to be able to say with any sort of certainty that he's innocent. Innocence is a very heavy word, and in our court system, we don't find people innocent. We find them not guilty. And I think that that's probably what's going to happen in this case, is that it'll end up being that there's just too much doubt, too much uncertainty to actually come up with a good, solid conviction here. We're not going to be able to say that the preponderance of evidence is enough to convict George Zimmerman of anything. So I see him getting let off. And then I think your last question was what about riots or what's the reaction going to be?
Yeah. Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know. I don't think we have the same type of heated reaction to this thing that we did with, like, the Rodney King situation. I think that it's there, but it's not as aggravated. I think if you're going to see anything, it's going to be in the towns that you would expect it in. You're going to see stupidity in Detroit. You're going to see stupidity in certain California cities. And I think it'll be short-lived. I think it'll be a couple hours of stupidity, and it'll get squashed down, and that'll be the end of it.
Yeah, I think you're kind of when this first came out, I think, just being a Reds Carey supporter, I wanted to believe that he did the right thing. But I think once within a day or two, when we got the information about his injuries and seeing blood on his back of his head and a broken nose, and then there was also a neighbor who had said that she saw Trayvon Martin on top of George Zimmerman. Right about that point, I went from kind of suspension of judgment at all to strongly leaning towards having a factual basis that this was probably a justified self-defense scenario. And that's kind of where I've stayed since then. I mean, we don't really know. It could very well be that I just don't see the evidence giving any indication of it. It could very well be that Trayvon Martin walked up and said, "Why are you following me?" And George Zimmerman attacked him. That could have happened, but I just don't see any evidence that it did. So, well, good. I'm worried to ask this question because it's been an hour and a half in this show, but how was the audio quality tonight? Do we have any issues?
Well, again, your audio hasn't really changed throughout the course of the show. You pretty much sounded the same throughout. Hopefully we can get that worked out again for next week. The calls that came through in your audio clips sounded great.
So other than having done the show from my bathroom this week, everything else sounded good.
Yeah. Not much. No issues that I noticed.
That sounds good, Dan. Well, I appreciate your help tonight, and we will plan next week. If you're around, we'll have our weekly broadcast, and have a good night.
Sounds great. Good night, Nick.
We'll talk to you soon. So that's the broadcast for tonight. Well-Earned Radio is going to sign off here. Makes me wonder how many people stick around for the whole hour and a half show. Sometimes I leave for some of those call-in topics for later in the show. We had more calls earlier in the show, it seems like. I had someone tell me last week that I should do an hour show, that an hour and a half is too long. So be interested to hear your feedback. Wellardradio@wi.rr.com if you've got any criticism, anything to share. And in the meantime, have a good week. Be well armed, and we will talk to you next week.